What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Dylan LeClaire is a student of Bitcoin and co-founder of 21st Paradigm. Dylan writes and contributes a ton of content regarding on-chain analytics and dope analysis of the financial markets and landscape via the Deep Dive with Bitcoin Magazine. He also contributes written pieces to Bitcoin Magazine, including the dynamite essay titled The Conclusion of the Long-Term Debt Cycle and the Rise of Bitcoin, subtitled The Conclusion of the Long-Term Debt Cycle is an Inescapable Economic Reality that Coincides with the Ascent of the Bitcoin Network. Dylan LeClaire, the man with a plan. Welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to rip.
Yeah, man. I'm very excited to have you here. It seems like you've come on the scene in a blast lately with just a lot of good content and signal. And I just kind of want to get into that. And first, I'd love to hear about what you're doing with 21st Paradigm. I think that's actually the first time I came across you on Twitter when you announced that you were starting this. So what's been going on there? How are you onboarding people and what's been the experience been like?
Yeah, so I mean, basically, for the past couple of years, after falling down the rabbit hole, I was kind of like the Bitcoin guy, I guess you could say, for friends and family. Just, you know, shirts, t-shirts, always kind of bringing it up, just, you know, shilling it. Had a lot of people kind of friends and family like reach out, but also like friends of friends and people that are kind of associates with me, but not too close. And I really spent the last couple of years like helping really everybody and like never thought of like, you know, charging anybody. But as this kind of the bull run kicked off a little bit, I started working with Bitcoin Magazine and doing some other stuff. Actually, I started working with Bitcoin Magazine after I launched 21st Paradigm. I really just kind of felt my schedule like filling up and my time was kind of running thin. So decided like, I'm still going to help friends and family, but I think I can provide a service to people when it comes to, I guess, explaining Bitcoin, doing any like onboarding businesses really onto a Bitcoin standard. And while it's not something that like, you know, I necessarily want to like go charge people for, I do understand that it's a service and it's something that really almost no one understands to it on a deep level. So I kind of, I spun up a thing where I just consult with people and small businesses, in my local area, about Bitcoin, really anything, whether it's macroeconomic policy or Bitcoin versus altcoins or really anything. And kind of, you know, using my 100, maybe 1,000 hours of research and, you know, geeking out over Bitcoin to help people.
Yeah. I'd love to hear how important it is to you to onboard people, kind of considering that, you know, and I think you've spoken about this, if someone contributes, you know, saves $5 in Bitcoin a day or even $1,000 in Bitcoin a day, that they're not really going to move price. It's not going to really help, you know, pump your bags. But what do you get from it maybe emotionally or, you know, philosophically about just getting people to understand Bitcoin and maybe their financial education?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's really awesome to see because I've like, I guess it would say like, you know, orange pilled a lot of people at this point, you know, maybe 50, 100. I don't really know, to be honest. Sure. I don't have a count, but, and that's from, you know, wealthy boomers who have, you know, $1 million portfolios to 18 year olds with $10 in their savings account and everywhere in between. I've really just kind of preached or really, you know, evangelized or explained the merits of Bitcoin and sound money to a lot of people and seeing people kind of wake up to that reality. And some people, you know, they buy some and forget about it or mm-hmm. panic sell or, you know, and that'll happen. There's, you know, for every person that you help, there will be people that, you know, stumble or maybe venture in onto Coinbase and altcoins and all that. But for a good amount of people, I've seen, honestly, in this, some people, if, you know, maybe if you're not down the rabbit hole or, you know, listening to your podcast, but I've seen lives change after people kind of come to understand Bitcoin and opportunity cost and, you know, buy a little bit every day. And I've literally seen lives change. Like I worked manual labor. I dropped out of school, like, so probably about a year ago now. And for 6 months after, I just worked manual labor, to stack sats. And I listened to a lot of podcasts along the way. And with my coworkers. They're, you know, hard workers, but no financial understanding, you know, just like no financial literacy. And I would, you know, lightly shill Bitcoin here or there. And as I worked longer and longer, I was just talking to a couple of guys in particular and got them stacking on Cash App. And like, and now they're just like obsessive savers. And I'm like, and I talked to them, I'm like, who would have thought 6 months ago you would be so obsessively saving for your future self? So it's kind of magic seeing that. But you know, that's Bitcoin. That's the rabbit hole. And that's where we are.
Yeah.
So it's powerful.
I think with this Bitcoin thing and just kind of economics and financial understanding, I think age is nothing but a number. It's really about ideas. If you're talking about investing, it's about performance, knowledge, know-how. So has there been, from your perception, a change in their perception of you based on your age and whether they got on board with Bitcoin or not, or saved with Bitcoin, but whether, did you notice whether people were receiving your ideas better as over time they saw these things play out the way you said they are going to, or did they, were they very receptive from the start? And I'll tack on that, you know, you don't have some of the fiat credentialism that a lot of people point to. So I'm really curious how people have taken to your opinions. And I listen to you on Twitter and it's the real deal. And I, you know, I'm blown away. So I'm just kind of curious what it's been like, you know, in real life.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a spectrum. I mean, definitely there are the, like I've talked with you know, friends, parents who are mutual fund managers and they're riding the 40 year credit boom. And I tell them, just buy and hold Bitcoin and you'll be set. And like trying to explain the stuff, and they look at me like they don't even really take in or, you know, care to even understand my perspective or ideas. It's like, what do you know? You're 20 years old. I'm like, yeah, you're right. But it's not me. It's my ideas. Right. Yeah, it's like, and so I've also seen people that are, you know, 40 years old or 18 or whatever. And it's always, okay, where are you coming from? What are your ideas and your perspective? Oh, wow. We talk for an hour. You really know your stuff. Where do you learn this? And I'm like, oh, Twitter, books, podcasts. I mean, and so, I've seen both. I mean, there's some that will be dismissive no matter what, like you talk to, you know, I haven't got a chance to talk to a Wall Street banker, but like, if I did, it's like, oh, what do you know, man? You dropped out of, you finished 1 year of college and you're obsessed about this magic internet money. Like, and so I don't know. I think as time goes on, as I've said the same things over and over again, and really just Bitcoiners in general, like, you know, it's going to go up forever. There's going to be volatility. The dollar is guaranteed to debase. It's programmatically going to increase in value over time. And it actually does, you know, it gives a little bit more, I don't know, like validity to your arguments and to your thesis. So I've seen that over the past couple of years, but still, I think there's still some vindication to come.
Yeah. I'm really curious about you choosing to forego college at this time and, you know, do, chase like the more the hardworking, earn money, stack sats sort of modus, you know, MO. And what kind of economic calculation was that for you? And more so in terms of, you know, guts and conviction, you know, around foregoing maybe the college experience as well as what everyone else is doing. And, you know, and I know you know this well, but people are sort of incentivized to go to college and, you know, through, you know, credit expansion. And so what was that decision like for you? And was it like something like a light bulb went off, or was it something you contemplated over a period of time?
Yeah, it was a lot of things at once. It kind of all came to a head. I was paying attention and like learning and studying Bitcoin probably since I was 18. I bought Bitcoin the day I turned 18 for the first time, learning about finance and economics and whatnot. I've always just kind of been a numbers guy. And I didn't really love science. So I was like, all right, you know, I'll go study business finance and, you know, I'll make something work. So I went to school. Technically it was just broadly business, but I was more interested in like economics and finance, local university, University of Vermont, 10,000 kids, really fun. And over the year had a great time. But you know, I was pushing off all my homework and on Twitter looking, you know, lurking on Bitcoin Twitter and reading and, you know, all these articles and, you know, as the year goes on, I'm really starting to dig into like the macro, kind of the backdrop of it all and finance and at the same time, Bitcoin, but you know, I wasn't like completely down the rabbit hole. And then kind of COVID came and I was like Twitter in general, Bitcoin, but like kind of like finance Twitter was like on top of it more than people were in general. And so at that point we got all sent home. The markets crashed, did pretty well during that crash because I was just paying attention and made some short bets on the equity markets. But at that point it was, and then the central banks kind of, you know, turned on the printers times a million. And I started, I read like Ray Dalio's like big debt crisis, which is kind of what I based my essay on and a couple other things. And kind of my thesis, like just, it was like a puzzle piece that like finally put it all together. It was like, okay, this Bitcoin thing's important, but I'm still trying to figure out this legacy system. And then all of a sudden March came and I was like, okay, wait, it's broke. It's really broken. And then at the same time, we get kicked out of the university and all get sent home and get sent on Zoom. So I'm like, okay, so I'm paying for this Zoom call. At the same time, I'm not even paying attention. My headphones aren't even in. I'm on Twitter learning this stuff for free. And like read and you know, I'm listening to the investors podcast with Preston Pish and he's recommending me books that I go buy for $13. And like, so what am I doing? And I was at the same time, I'm getting massive FOMO because the halving's coming up and everybody's super bullish and the price is at like $6,000. And like, so I'm like, all right, well, I need money and I don't have it. So I did something I thought I would never do. And I dropped out and I went and I worked for a family business doing electrical work. Not fun. But, you know, I was making an income living at home and I did that for 6, 7, 8 months. I don't remember exactly. And listened to 7 hours of podcasts a day and audio books and all of this. And I stacked my ass off. The going back and studying Keynesian economics just didn't make sense. It was just like, you know, it was two clear things. It was, okay, what do I believe in? Well, I believe that information is free and abundant. You know, the university, the credentials, all of this stuff, the upside of going to college and getting this piece of paper has never been lower. Right. And at the same time, the opportunity cost of foregoing that has never been higher. Bitcoin at, you know, 7,000, even Bitcoin today. Right. Like, and so I was like, okay, well, what's better for my future self going and accumulating capital. So that's what I did and decided I'd never go back probably middle of the summer. And you know, kind of found myself with a job off Twitter, 6, 7, 8 months later. So, it worked out, but you know, still in the process.
Yeah. I'm really curious what might've been the signal to you that turned Bitcoin from maybe something that you could make money on to something way more important, whatever that meant. Like for me, it was like listening to Bitcoin Tina talk about the value of money and how money is half of every transaction. And then if you look at what, you know, where a store of value is being trapped and you start thinking of the enormous pie and this, and what we're going for versus, you know, gains or just another way of investing. And that was kind of my aha moment. Was there something that really kind of turned the corner for you or was it just an accumulation of knowledge?
Yeah. I read the Bitcoin Standard and I like, I'm learning all this stuff on the fly. I don't know the Keynesian system. I don't know Bitcoin and I'm learning it both at the same time. And right. So I reading the Bitcoin Standard, reading all this stuff, it kind of goes over my head, but I get it. I get, you know, like people think this is going to be valuable. You know, I'm 19 years old, like, you know, not necessarily cryptocurrencies, but I don't even know what I don't know. Mm-hmm. Digital currency makes sense to me, right? It's not like I have any mental model to go off of. And as I start learning more and more about the legacy system, it was like, okay, wait, this is really, really broken. What does all this debt mean? Well, as I kind of, you know, did some digging and figured out what interest rates were and, you know, central bank monetary policy and, you know, what debt loads mean and why debt is good or bad or just what it means. And then I read that like the big debt crisis and like understanding kind of why gold has value and why gold when you're in these debt crises, why gold for hundreds of years, you flock to gold, right? And like making that connection, and then kind of understanding like monetary economics and how all money and monetary mediums compete against each other, and Bitcoin being like definitively the best one of those. And so probably, yeah, I think 2019, I got it and I was buying, but 2020, probably around March or April, was when it flipped for me that like, this is the opportunity cost of everything. And like dollar gains be damned, I don't care. Like I just need this, my sat count to go up forever.
Yeah. How much of not having a mental model do you think is an advantage in this sort of us? Yeah. It's so interesting. So, you know, you quickly picked up at Bitcoin Magazine. The content's been phenomenal. And I'm not sure exactly how you've been then long, how long you've been there, maybe 4, 5, 6, 7 months, I think you said. But right away, Bitcoin 2021, I'm kind of curious what your thoughts about that was, what the experience was like for you.
It was amazing. I mean, so I went to BitBlock Boom in 2020 in August. It was like 300 maximalists, really fun, tight-knit group of, you know, just like a lot of Twitter anons and whatnot. But and Gary Leland put it on an awesome thing. But Bitcoin 2021 was like just a whole nother level of an order of magnitude more people in Miami. Was there for a week. The speakers were awesome. Just like so much enthusiasm. And then, you know, to end it off, like it was a great weekend. And then to end it off with Jack Mahler's, you know, and his emotional speech announcing that Bitcoin was going to be like legal tender, and not even just that, but that like it's a start of people that are disadvantaged all over the world who are pillaged by central bank printing, that there's now this escape for them. And it was like, it was super emotional. And like I was teary eyed in the crowd, like this is so much bigger than me. This is, and like, it was just a really powerful moment. So the conference was amazing. I mean, I there was some logistic issues, but yeah, it's kind of going to be expected when there's 10,000 people, and our team worked out the kinks, and it was really, really great time.
Yeah. What did you think of Floyd Mayweather?
I didn't see his entire talk, but I caught a little bit of it. And I don't know. It wasn't the best. It wasn't my favorite.
Yeah. I caught it on one of those screens outside. At first I kind of got really annoyed. And then the more I thought about it, I just kind of loved it. I thought it was just, you know, it was a spectacle. I loved how he had the arrogance to think that he was going to win over the crowd using whatever tactics he used in terms of his resume or just appealing to people's freedom of choice, even though we had all kind of made our decision and done our homework. So I kind of just saw it. I started to appreciate it the more I got further away from it. And I just enjoyed it for what it was. I'd love to turn to your article. It's really a great piece. And as I said at the top of the show, it's called The Conclusion of the Long-Term Debt Cycle and the Rise of Bitcoin. And so I really want to get into cycles here and, you know, the cyclicity of debt. And if you could kind of explain, you know, what are the cycles of debt, specifically the short-term cycles that, you know, maybe we're more familiar with, but not everyone thinks about what the cycles are that we're going through.
Yeah. So, I mean, and I think I start off this explanation in the piece, but like debt in the most simple way is cyclical. And the fact that you're not borrowing only from a lender, but you're borrowing from your future self. So you're pulling forward demand or you're pulling forward consumption. And so debt can be a good thing if you use it to invest, you know, productively, right? If you do it to produce more income for yourself, it's a good thing. But if you use debt to buy a TV, or if you use debt to consume or whatever, gamble, whatever it is, debt is painful, because you're basically, you're spending your future income, you're spending your future productivity.
I think that's the hinge for me, and I'm so sorry to interrupt, but I think just that point alone is so important, because most people, I think, see it as I can afford to take on this debt. Therefore, I can afford this thing. I can afford this TV that I can't necessarily afford because I'll be able to afford the payments. And they don't see that as necessarily a reduction in future consumption. They might think that they're going to get a raise or just somehow it's going to work out that they won't have to do without. I think that's fascinating just on the microeconomic level, but I think we're going to talk about more here at the macro level.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great point. Like a lot of people, it's so easy, right? You're like, you know, oh, I'll just finance it. And that's true right. for like, you know, whether you're buying AirPods or, you know, college. MacBook, or whether you're college or a mortgage, right? Like, oh, you know, it's $1 million home and it's kind of expensive, but I can put 5% down and I can amortize that over 30 years. Right. So like, you know, it's, and that's, you know, not only like an individual level, like we're saying, but that's true. That applies for at a macroeconomic level for entire sectors, for entire economic systems. And so that's kind of why you see these cycles, these, you know, these boom and bust cycles per se, you know, productivity gains, and just like declines of productivity, while it may be natural per se, what's not natural is setting the price of money. And when you do set the price of money, which is what central banking does, you will see these huge credit expansions. People are borrowing. That could be many times that, you know, it is used to invest productively, but, you know, the upward swing of a credit boom, asset prices are going up, speculative activity increases, consumption, people feel rich, people, and eventually all, you know, any borrowing that occurs, or not any, but most of the borrowing that occurs isn't used productively, but actually starts to be used for consumption for the things that don't increase your future income. And that's not a good thing. And so that's kind of when people think of, you know, the short-term debt cycle can be thought of as like the business cycle, right? Like most people, while they may not understand all like the intricacies of, you know, economics and yada, yada, people really kind of, you know, the business cycle, right? Like, oh, there's a recession. You know, well, why did a recession happen? It's not like technology just got really bad. These are things that are driven by credit, and credit's like not really understood. But people can, you can just think of it as, you know, a ratio of like incomes versus what you owe, which is debt. And so you can continue to pull forward demand. And especially if after, you know, if there is some recession, what central banks do, what governments do, is they lower the price of money, they lower the cost of money, and then everyone feels good again. Eventually, whether on a short-term time scale, a time frame or a long-term time frame, the music stops and you have to pay that, all of that demand, all that consumption you pulled forward. And that's the part that people don't really like.
Yeah. It seems like we're having these major crunches every 7 or 10 years that fits this cyclical nature that we're speaking of. What's been your impression of the last 40 years in terms of interest rates and business expansion and contraction?
In 1981, that was kind of the cyclical peak of interest rates, right? So 1981, the Fed funds rate was like, I think 20%. We had massive inflation. The gold peg came off in 1971. There's a lot of inflation that followed. It wasn't just because of the gold peg. There was some demographics, like there was tight like oil supply chains, yada yada. But inflation was running hot. Paul Volcker, central banker, came in and kept raising rates all the way up to basically squash this inflation. So interest rates in 1981 hit a peak of 20%. And from there, it's basically been a step pattern all the way down. And so you've had these cycles of from 20% down to, I don't even know, just like 14%, right? And so everybody in that scenario, well, credit money just became cheaper. So anybody, you can go borrow. Well, if you have a mortgage at 20% and interest rates go to 14%, your house is worth more. The stock market's up. You feel richer. You can borrow at cheaper rates. You can refinance. So it's, everybody feels good. Productivity is going up. People are richer. You know, businesses are, you know, booming. And so you have these kind of cycles. Well, eventually debt kind of piles up in these things, and our inflation runs hot, and central banks try to revert back to the mean, but they never get interest rates back to where they were at the previous cyclical peak. And so, well, what comes next is a recession, and they cut rates and they do it all over again. And so we've kind of, this is a very like big oversimplification, but what we've seen for basically the last 40 years is credit expansion, debt loads get too high, debt to income ratios get too high. They need to be serviced. For them to be serviced, you have to defer consumption and pay back the debt. Well, when you defer consumption, your consumption is another person's income. Your spending is another person's income. So now the other person on the other side of your spending that you're doing, whether that was with your income or with credit you borrowed, well, that person isn't receiving as much income either, but they need to pay. And so it's just this cycle on the way down. And so central banks come in, it's totally understandable. It's human incentives, right? We're going to kick the can. We're going to grease the wheels a little bit so that they cut the cost of money. And so they did this for 40 years. And we hit the zero lower bound in 08 after the financial crisis, when there was, totally understandable, but the banks, would have gone insolvent. And so they cut rates to zero and they shoved a bunch of money in the system. And, we kicked the can for about 10 years. Here we are again. And so this is kind of the beginning of the end, or maybe we're past the beginning stages of the end of the long-term debt cycle.
Yeah, well, you bring up the long-term debt cycle. So, what is it exactly and why are so many people unfamiliar with it?
Yeah, so, I mean, the long-term debt cycle is a little more complicated because myself for sure, but most people have never lived through one. Really, everybody on the planet today, we've kind of had this one monetary regime. It's kind of the way things work, and it doesn't really go beyond that surface level. But these short-term debt cycles, they kind of all lead to this, they build into this long-term debt cycle. And Ray Dalio has a fantastic three-part book series that's really, it's called Navigating Big Debt Crises. But he also has, for people that don't want to go read, three big books, he has a 30-minute YouTube video that's really fantastic. And I tell people, you'll learn more in this video than you will about, from your econ course.
Right. The principles for navigating big debt crisis. It's great.
Yeah. Yep. And so it's a really, really good YouTube video. And it basically kind of describes what I'm describing here. But the long-term debt cycle comes when interest rates at zero, and basically the central banks no longer have the ability to make the price of money any lower. So debt loads are super, super high. They've been accumulating higher and higher and higher following each credit contraction and central banks lower rates. So instead of the bad debt and malinvestment wiping out, instead of bad business investments and all of this stuff getting rightfully liquidated, every time you lower the cost of money, the price of money, aka the interest rates, all of these things are able to survive. They're able to sustain themselves. Well, when you hit the zero lower bound, the game of central banks making cost of money lower to sustain these debt levels can no longer happen. So when you have something like March of 2020, when you have COVID, and that was a really exaggerated event, a 5-6 standard deviation event. These pandemics where you shut down everything don't happen often, but a recession was coming regardless. Credit was the credit expansion and the contraction that follows was coming regardless. And so rates hit the zero lower bound, and what can central banks do? Well, to make debt levels more sustainable, and to put liquidity into the system, which is essentially what lowering the cost of capital does. They basically short form printed money. It's called quantitative easing. They take all of these all of the bonds off these balance sheets, aka debt that these banks are owed that wouldn't be paid, and they say, okay, well, this contract was worth $100. Well, it's not really worth $100 because it probably wouldn't have been paid. But they say, hey, this $100 that might have been 80, might have been 70, might have been whatever, we'll give you $100 for it and we'll take it off your hands. And so it basically all it does is they're just repairing balance sheets as fast as they can to basically keep the system afloat. Because if they didn't, well, the asset side of your balance sheet falls and falls and falls, but the liability side remains. And that's that. And it just, and this happens at, to the banks, then to the corporates, then to the individuals, and it cascades all the way down. So at this point in the long-term debt cycle, that's the entire game, is that the banks, everybody's up to their eyeballs in debt, but they can't make the cost of capital any cheaper. So they have to continue to basically, the quantitative easing, the stimulus checks to people, the, you know, debt forgiveness, all this stuff, we're just starting, and they have no alternative, because if they don't, the entire system collapses. So we're kind of at the end game.
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, you bring up the end game. It's very strong words. We're at the end of a very long cycle, it seems. I mean, my whole life has been half of one of these cycles. And so you're riding, you know, sort of the upside of the wave in a lot of ways in terms of credit expansion. And when I was 18, 19, 20 years old, and I think the economics were very different then in terms of what college cost and what someone could make coming out of college. And I was lucky. My parents financed my college by taking on the debt themselves. So it wasn't like they had a pot of gold for me, but, you know, they took that burden off of me. And I remember coming, you know, around the dot-com crisis, it was like, hey, maybe I'll even go to grad school for a couple of years and sit this out, this contraction. That was like maybe one way to ride the wave, and 7 to 10 year wave. But so now we're, you know, we've kind of covered the three types of monetary policy that, you know, the banks or the state can use to deal with these cycles. We've talked about interest rates and sort of the last 40 years, they've been crumbling. Quantitative easing, I think we're all kind of familiar with now. But the newest one is stimulus payments and UBI. And where do you think this is going over the next maybe 3 to 5 years in terms of stimulus payments and maybe UBI?
Yeah, so in Dalio's book, he outlines this, and it was pretty surreal reading it. I read this three-part book in March or April, maybe May. And it was surreal because he wrote it in 2008, and he was using case studies from the last 120 years, maybe. So it wasn't like, you know, it was like this, someone wrote this when I was reading it. It was like, oh my God, this is all happening right now. And he outlined the three types of monetary policy. He said, all right, well, check. If once they can't manipulate interest rates any lower, they're going to start quantitative easing. Well, quantitative easing works initially because there's a liquidity crunch, right? So no one wants to lend. No one has cash that they want to lend out because financial conditions are very stressed. So pump in some liquidity and get everything moving again. It does have a wealth effect. It does work. Well, eventually, or, you know, after the initial liquidity crunch, all that quantitative easing, well, it's a great thing for asset prices. It's a great thing for financial markets. It's not a great thing for society at large, because there's a class of people that have assets, and there's a small class of people that hold the majority of the assets. And there's, you know, and so for in the United States, it's like 50% of people don't have any assets. 50% of people have no savings. And so, you know, you'll see central banks, you'll see the government say, well, the last 10 years, inflation's been 2%. Well, they're right for CPI. The consumer price index has been 2-3%. You know, we could say that's bogus, but, you know, it's around there. Prices, you know, and that's with technological deflation making things cheaper. Okay, 2-3% cost of living. Well, M2 money supply has grown about 10-12% every single year. If you held the long bond, or if you held the NASDAQ over the last 10 years, you're getting 12-13% compounded annual returns. Well, that's inflation, right? But that's not how it's measured. And that's a big, you know, second order effect of quantitative easing. You're stuffing all this money into financial markets, and it's not leaving. Like, you inject $1 trillion into the bond market. Okay. So a bond investor swaps his asset with the Fed. That money doesn't go into the real economy. It goes into the equity market. It stays in the bond market. It goes into real estate, right? Like, that, it pumps financial assets, but in the process, it polarizes society, because there's the haves who are, you know, I love this Fed, please, you know, more QE, you know, keep easing, we're all doves. And then there's the have nots who, a lot of them don't, like a majority of the, you know, so-called have nots don't understand the game that's being played. They don't understand why things are becoming more expensive. They don't understand why life's becoming harder. And so the UBI comes in because, and really populism, right? Like, we saw it, we saw it with Bernie Sanders. We saw it to an extent with Donald Trump, right? He's like, make America great again. We're going to onshore all our jobs. We're gonna, you guys have been screwed by, and it's you've been screwed by someone, and I'm gonna help you. That's populism, right? That's, you know, what, like Joe Biden and, or just like, really, it's not even about the actors. It's, you've been screwed, we're here to help. You want stimulus checks? You want money? You want rent forgiveness? You want student loan forgiveness? That's coming, right? Like, there's my entire generation has loans that will never be repaid ever. Yeah. Right. So, I mean, and with democracy, it's basically, you know, it's like, there's a pretty good term for democracy. I can't think of it at the time. But it's only just incentives. These people have been pillaged and they want something in return. So that's kind of where UBI, stimulus, and really socialism, but in a way we've seen for the last couple decades, but really the last decade with this massive quantitative easing in the financial system is socialism for the rich. QE is socialism for the rich. Mm-hmm. And so now you're seeing like, do I think UBI is a good thing? Of course not. I'm a proponent of free market capitalism, but saying that, you have to acknowledge that quantitative easing and interest rate manipulation and, you know, manipulating the cost of capital, really central banking is inherently a socialist, you know, it's in the Communist Manifesto. It's a Marxist institution. So, you know, the stimulus and the UBI money for the people is really just a natural progression of things. And when you look at history, that all kind of becomes clear.
Yeah, I agree. I wonder, what do you make of like the $1 trillion, $2 trillion, $3 trillion stimulus package? I mean, these are huge numbers. I don't think a lot of people are spending time thinking about how large these numbers are.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, like I'm sitting with a very large majority of my wealth in Bitcoin. And, you know, whether it's $1 trillion or $5 trillion or whatever, I know they're coming, and I know, you know, a majority of the money is not, I'm not seeing it, right? Like, okay, here's a $1,000 stimulus check. Well, okay, there's 300 million Americans, and okay, let me do the math here. That's 300 billion. Where's the other 4 trillion going? Like,
right,
or whatever the numbers are, right? So, I mean, they're going to keep coming. They're going to continue. They have to, because if they don't continue to expand the money supply, if there is not ever more credit contraction, the system unwinds. And so, and also with the dollar being the world reserve currency, we literally have to run deficits for the world. I forget his first name, but the Trifon dilemma, this was predicted. It was saying, whoever runs the world reserve currency, you're going to have to be a deficit. You're going to have to perpetually run deficits because you're going to have to supply dollars or whatever the currency is to the world. And so, a second order effect of us being the world reserve currency is what we mentioned before, where all of our domestic manufacturing got offshored, right? All of this stuff as a result of having an artificially strong currency and having to be a dollar exporter around the world. We basically export our dollar, like the US is number one export, it's dollars. We basically print our dollars, send it out to the world. We get oil, we get manufactured goods, we get all this stuff. That's great for a consumer, but it's really bad for our workforce, our domestic manufacturing. It's horrible for the Rust Belt. It's great for like the coastal elites. And so you have kind of all these factors at play. And is it all a function of monetary policy and central banking and yada yada? No, but the reality is that, you know, like you said, money is 50% of every transaction. And when the money is broken, like very broken, and like, you know, there's this good analogy, like there's these two fish swimming in water, and this other fish comes up to them and goes, "How's the water, boys?" And they said, "Oh, what's water?" And it's like, well, that's what's happening. It's like, everybody knows like the world's messed up right now. They're like, okay, well, something's awry. Everything's really broken. Like, this is almost laughable. Like, what's going on here? Well, the money's breaking down, like as we, you know, as we speak, but we're all living through it. And no one really comes to ask like, oh, you know, what does this mean?
Yeah. Well, for in a mental model, let's take Bitcoin out of it, out of the equation. Where does this go without Bitcoin? How long does it take to destroy the money, the US dollar? Is it a Japanification where maybe we have 20, 30 more years of, you know, sort of stagnant economy, or is this something that's going to crumble in 3 to 5 years?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, if not for Bitcoin, I'd probably be a gold bug, as depressing as that is. Mm-hmm. I think so with Japan, they were like kind of the first country. They had this massive credit bubble, I think in the 90s. And yeah, for the last 20, 30 years, they've had this basically like almost deflation, and their society has been, they've had almost no growth. Interest rates have been at zero. Everyone's up to their eyeballs in debt. But it's kind of different where now this is a global phenomenon where, so, I mean, interest rates aren't zero everywhere, but the US Treasury is where the world reserve currency, and the US Treasury is basically the risk-free rate of the world, and every other currency and every other central bank rate off of that is essentially in real terms, like adjusted for inflation or currency weakness, it's basically at zero as well. So you have basically the entire world is going through this debt cycle and not just Japan. Are not just, you know, one country, whereas Japan, it's just kind of isolated. They have a current account surplus where they produce more than they consume. Unlike the US where we have a current accounts deficit, we have actually twin deficit. We have a deficit in terms of, our debt, but we also consume far more than we produce. And so where would this go without Bitcoin is a really tough question. It's revolution. I mean, I think in a way Bitcoin is a revolution in its own way, but yeah, these things end with a huge power struggle that you know in the past turned quite ugly. In a way like war, revolution. I don't know. I think, and one part of the reason I'm so passionate about Bitcoin is that I view it as really one of our only ways out of this thing. Without it, and it might be messy, but without it being, you know, just devastatingly messy.
Yeah, I definitely think Bitcoin is the peaceful revolution. It's interesting you bring it up that there would be revolution if we didn't have Bitcoin. I think of that as, like you were saying, more violent. I think there would be more war than necessarily revolution. I think revolution would be squashed without Bitcoin. I think through things like, you know, digital currencies, but, you know, CBDCs and financial surveillance and that stuff would just be squashed. How is Bitcoin, you know, sort of as digital gold, how is that a Trojan horse? How does technology change the rules?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's pretty, so like, what do you mean a Trojan horse? Like,
You know, so now we have Bitcoin and we're sort of fighting this peaceful revolution, and yet it's not necessarily overt in all manners. But, you know, how does technology change the rules here or change the game? You know, now that we bring Bitcoin into the equation, what kind of release valve is Bitcoin?
Yeah. So, you know, in the 1920s, after the Great Depression, right. It was, there was the same credit bubble. There was, it burst and we were on a gold standard. And so what happened was, the way they kind of got out of the credit bubble was that they eventually it burst in 1929. There was couple years of ugly depression. They finally got rid of the gold peg, and then they confiscated everyone's gold, and they said, all right, we're going to devalue against gold. And which essentially eroded the debt in real terms. So that was the kind of the way that they devalued, because in a credit contraction, right, you have all of these IOUs, you have all these claims, and it's collapsing downwards. And gold served on a gold standard. Gold served as like this, you know, this bearer asset that has no counterparty risk. It's just a monetary asset that you can hold and you know you have it. And so if someone else has it, well, you got a claim on that and you don't really have it. And so now we're on a fiat standard where everything is credit. It's all IOUs built on top of each other on a fractional reserve banking system, which is, you know, everyone's lent out more money than they actually have. And money itself is just like, if you look at a dollar bill, it says like a note that's due to the Federal Reserve. It's essentially like a dollar is a liability on the Fed's balance sheet. A dollar in circulation is literally a debt of the Federal Reserve. So when you have this credit cycle and well, you're at the end of it, well, right now it's credit expansion that you're trying to protect yourself. It's every asset's going up, cash is trash, let me get out. Well, it eventually ends this, you know, and it would end tomorrow if they stopped printing money, but it eventually ends with the collapse. It eventually ends with massive deflationary bust, credit contraction. You know, if you're holding someone else's liability, you're screwed. And so with Bitcoin, you kind of have this, you have this escape valve where you don't have to ask permission. You have people all over the world. It's literally information that you can go out, you can acquire some, you can exchange your value for, and the proof of work and the difficulty adjustment, your value is insulated against literally anybody else. It's like, you know, Michael Saylor says, and when he first said this, kind of blew me away. He was like, Bitcoin is the first thermodynamically sound monetary network. It literally respects the laws of physics and the laws of thermodynamics. And so all over the world, you have people that, you know, say, I don't really care what institutions or central banks or governments say, I'm going to acquire this thing. I'm going to provide value to someone with a good or service, and I'm going to save money. And so I don't have to hold anyone else's liability. I don't have to be at the whim of any one person. And, you know, I can memorize words in my head and save my value. And so that's happening at an individual level in every jurisdiction on the planet. And it's really, we're lucky to have it, because without it, it would be super, super ugly. You know, this unwind, not only from a financial point of view, which I kind of focus on, but from a social unrest point of view, from a societal point of view, without this escape hatch where, you know, they're going to keep printing money because that's the incentive. Without that, right? Like the reason I'm like such an annoying Bitcoin shill to all my friends and family, it's not because I'm like, you know, like people think, you're trying to pump your bags. Well, no, I'm trying to like, you know, get you on the arc. Like, this is really important. And there is no alternative. So, you know, the escape hatch of this centrally planned nightmare that we find ourselves in is a decentralized system of rules and not rulers. And ultimately that's Bitcoin. And so, yeah, I do believe it is an inevitability, and I believe it is, you know, the escape hatch.
Yeah. In the escape hatch sense, are we on the road to freedom, to serfdom without it? And, you know, are there going to be people that are going to be left behind because they don't get on the arc?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely believe we're on the road to, I mean, I think we're there really in terms of, you know, you have a class of people that disproportionately benefit from central bank monetary policy, government interventionism, and you know, like, I wouldn't even call it capitalism. I mean, in a way, it's like pseudo capitalism, but quasi capitalism, but yeah. It's really not, right? And so you have a lot of people that are debt slaves. Like, I mean, the Federal Reserve is a private bank. Like quite literally, like you have, and this is like, you know, maybe it's conspiratorial, but you have literally an entire planet that is indebted at the hands of these individuals at the top of this kind of pyramid, at the top of the literal pyramid scheme. And so central banking is kind of a road to serfdom where you have everybody, the incentive, it's all debt. Everything's debt. To literally, money's created, a dollar is created through debt. Like, that's the way that the credit system works. And so, you know, college, anything, really, credit cards, like you have people that are literally slaving away, and at the end of their, you know, their life, they have nothing to show for it. And like, that is literally like neo serfdom in a way. And so, yeah, I think Bitcoin fixes this, and it's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen next year, or maybe even next decade. I think it will, but it kind of just naturally realigns incentives for everybody.
Yeah. Do we even know who owns the Federal Reserve? I mean, I'm assuming it's not Jerome Powell.
No, I think there are private shareholders, and the shareholders are some of the banks, but I don't believe that Elon Musk is the richest man in the world. I I think there are some people pulling the strings, but you know, that's maybe another talk for another day.
Sure, fair enough. I'd love to hear your thoughts on Michael Saylor and specifically the speculative attack that he's launching, borrowing a lot of money. If you could kind of explain how it is a speculative attack.
Yeah, so a speculative attack, it's been kind of popularized because of what Saylor's doing and through Bitcoin. Pierre Richard published an amazing piece. It's like quite prophetic. In 2014, called the speculative attack. But a speculative attack is essentially is in the most simple sense, it's borrowing in a weak currency and acquiring a strong one. So, you know, to kind of go back on a fiat, you know, fiat money, when you borrow money, it actually creates money. Like when a commercial bank lends, it creates money. And that seems kind of counterintuitive, but to put it simply, if I lend you money, I now have an asset that bears interest and you have a liability, but you also have the cash on hand. So you have $100 in cash in your pocket now, and I have $100 plus interest that I'm owed. So there's now $200 right in the economy. So I just, through the act of lending, you create fiat. And so a speculative attack is where you borrow in a weak currency. You think there's an opportunity in the market, and you think that these currency pair is mispriced. So you go out and you borrow in the currency that you believe is weak. You borrow it, you instantly sell that currency, whether it's dollar, euro, yen, rupee, it doesn't matter. And you acquire your strong asset. It could be gold, it could be the euro, it could be Bitcoin. So Michael Saylor is going out and he's doing it, you know, in the hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. To be honest, that's still quite small. That's really small, small scale, but he's doing it, you know, in a quite public manner. And for Bitcoin, it's pretty significant. He's going out and he did it a couple times with different sort of debt, but for the most part, you know, just to keep it simple, borrowing at 0%, $1 billion for 7 years, and he's going and buying Bitcoin. So he's acquiring dollars. Dollars are created through this process. There's more dollars in the circulation because of it. And he goes and acquires Bitcoin that there will only ever be 21 million. And he's going to sit on it forever. And so, I mean, I've personally borrowed money to buy Bitcoin. You know, people will say, like, you know, some people would admonish that and say, oh, that's really bad. Don't do that. It's really risky. Well, the reality is, if you hold any Bitcoin personally at all, and you have any sort of debt, you are in a way borrowing to buy Bitcoin. If you have a liability on your personal balance sheet or business or whatever, and you have Bitcoin on the asset side, well, you made a choice. You made an active decision to not pay down your liabilities and acquire Bitcoin. And so really that, and in a way that is a speculative attack. And so through this process of people all over the world, but, you know, especially the Michael Saylor types who do it in the billions, who people just stacking sats and, you know, saying, I'm going to acquire this hard money at the expense of paying down my soft money liabilities. You have the Bitcoin exchange rate continuing to appreciate. And so there's just that kind of mispriced, the price of money is completely artificially suppressed, right? So the cost of capital is near zero. Michael Saylor can go out and he just borrowed at 6%, but 6%, okay, I'll pay 6% interest for 7 years. And all the mental math is Bitcoin or whatever it is going to outpace 6% a year? Is Bitcoin going to outpace his first offering? Is Bitcoin going to outpace 0% per year by 2028? Okay, is it? Yes. Should I do it? Then yes. And it's that simple. And so, you know, if you can borrow at 3%, do it, right? To buy Bitcoin, that's great. And to be honest, I wouldn't call that risky. Even at 60,000, like, is Bitcoin going to be, you know, top of the head math, like 75, 80,000 in 5 years? Well, if you think it is, then it's a good idea to borrow at 3% to acquire some. And so that, you know, in a short sense, that's a speculative attack, and that's why it's so genius.
Yeah, I agree. How do you frame up Bitcoin is the least volatile asset, the risk-free rate, and sort of if you could explain what the Sharpe ratio is and how that kind of, you know, enables the argument.
Yeah, so, well, I say Bitcoin is the least volatile asset. That's kind of thinking in like a Bitcoin standard sort of way where one BTC equals one BTC. You know, there'll only be 21 million and actually Bitcoin is the least volatile thing. It is the most certain asset on the planet. You know, you can verify with your own node. The terminal inflation rate of Bitcoin is zero. The supply is completely inelastic. It is, you know, programmatic issuance, yada, yada. The volatility in dollar sense, when you're thinking about a Sharpe ratio is essentially, you can do annualized performance or, you know, 4-year performance, or you can do it on different timeframes, but, people say Bitcoin's so volatile. Correct. Bitcoin is very volatile. But if you want to compare apples to oranges, yeah, Bitcoin's not good. Well, if you want to compare apples to apples, Bitcoin is very volatile, but it's also the best performing asset on really any time scale. I mean, the last 3 months, no, but over the last year, over the last 4 years, if you compare Bitcoin to any other asset over a 4-year span, yeah, there's 80% drawdowns. There's definitely a ton of volatility. Bitcoin is like one of the most volatile macro assets, but it's the best performer. And so when you look at Sharpe ratios, which is annualized performance or you know, 12 months, 48 months, 6 months, whatever, divided by the volatility, you can see, you know, how it's basically Sharpe ratio is a risk adjusted return. And so Bitcoin has basically been one of the highest Sharpe ratio assets ever. There's nothing like it. And so that's what kind of makes it a must own if you're thinking in dollar terms.
Yeah, I hear that. So I'd love to turn to, you know, on-chain data analysis and metrics. And what are some of the things that are you would look at either to start the day or just kind of get a handle on what's going on?
Yeah, so I mean, on-chain analytics is super cool. I started digging into this a couple of months ago, but it's unlike anything else with, you know, on-chain analytics. It's unlike anything in the, you know, legacy financial system, because the Bitcoin network are really, I guess, blockchains in general, but really I only look at Bitcoin. It's completely transparent, right? So you can see this ledger of everything that's ever happened, of every economic movement on the Bitcoin network, when the last time a certain coin or, you know, batch of coins was moved. And so on-chain analytics, you have these really awesome data providers. And, you know, people used to do this alone, like Willy Wu, who kind of pioneered all this, literally like formatted all this data by himself. I can never do that. So props to those guys. Basically if you run a Bitcoin node, all that data that, you know, we're posting with all these charts and stuff, it's there and it's complete, you know, all you got to do is format it. So, you know, some of the stuff that I look at, you can see like, on a given day, what like is the age of coins that are being spent. And so, most of the time, like vast majority of volume on chain, it's coins that have moved in like, you know, literally the last day, the last week, the last month. When you kind of reach like sometimes like a cyclical peak or like a top of a bull market, it's when a lot of like old coins, it's when a lot of like hodled coins start to move. And so I don't know, there's just really a lot of interesting stuff you can kind of look at on chain. You can see like realized price. So everybody knows what, right, the price is. Everybody knows what the market cap is. Market cap, price times the amount of coins. But realized market cap is what is the value of every coin when it was last moved. So if coins were sent to a wallet when Bitcoin was trading at $1, if 100 Bitcoin were sent to a wallet at that point, well, Bitcoin could be trading at 38,000 today, but those coins are each counted in the realized cap as $1 a piece. Mm. So realized cap is more of like a true metric in terms of like the value of the network. It's when it's the value that of every single coin when it was last moved. And so you can do some cool things where like you take the price or the market cap of Bitcoin at any one point and you divide it against the realized price or the realized cap, and it gives you a ratio. And when this ratio like peaks, when this ratio hits really high levels, it's like, I mean, I plan to hodl, but it's a good time to maybe take some chips off the table, or it's a good time to, you know, maybe sit on some cash and wait for a pullback. So I mean, that's just one example, but it's really cool just with on-chain, and it's unlike anything else, you know, in the legacy system for sure.
Yeah. That's awesome. I'd also love to hear about some of the market analysis and what you think is going on right now. You know, you released a thread on it today. Just, you know, right now, just to frame it up, we're going through sort of, it seems like a pullback from a local all-time high of around 65,000. We're sitting at 38,000 now. What do you see in the marketplace? Again, just really from the metrics and the data.
Yeah, so, I mean, nothing that I really am looking at screams kind of like like cyclical peak, right? It's more of, and Plan B said this and a couple other people, and it kind of looks a little similar in the charts. It seems like a 2013 kind of, you know, mid-cycle pullback or mid bull run pullback. A lot like, you know, everything that I've seen, I do not expect a full 80% retracement and protracted bear market, especially just at the fundamentals when you have nation states adopting it and whatnot. It really seems to be just a leverage in the Bitcoin market phenomenon. And so in 2017, there wasn't really there were derivative markets, but it wasn't fully developed. And so this cycle you have a lot of leverage in the system, and it's a good and a bad thing, right? So there are no bailouts, there are no, you know, manipulation, there's no one coming to save anybody. But you have a lot of like native leverage. So I can send one Bitcoin to an exchange and I can trade with 50 Bitcoin of value. Well, if the price moves up 2% or down 2% in the wrong direction, I get wiped out. And so you have a lot of really, really bullish market participants in Bitcoin and or, you know, crypto broadly. And anybody that's, you know, holding a good amount of value in this network is, you know, very biased towards the bullish, you know, end of things. And so the market got very, very bullish and pretty over leveraged. And what we kind of saw was a mix of just, you know, very healthy 20-30% market pullback. Saw that like 5-6 times in 2017. And honestly, with a volatile asset like Bitcoin, like it's just, you know, the way things go, like there's honestly like a lot of people will ask for, okay, what's the reason it pulled back? I don't know. No one knows. It's just, you know, it's just entropy. It's just, you know, randomness. And so it was a mix of, you know, a regular pullback, some, you know, Elon and some other just weird factors that kind of came into play. And along with, there was a lot of leverage in the system that never really kind of got washed out. And as we went from 64 to 48 to 40 to 38, that leverage, everybody that was kind of leveraged up over, you know, and underwater, instead of exiting out and taking a loss, they doubled down, they doubled down, and they doubled down. And that's why we kind of saw that crazy flush, you know, I think it was like May 18th, May 19th, you know, at one point it was minus 27% in an hour. It was like, well, why did that happen? It was like, well, because there was huge blowups. And so, you know, right now we're sitting 38,000, very, very healthy. It's, you know, pretty organic price. Not a lot of leverage or derivative buildup there. And so I kind of expect just, you know, a consolidation, but kind of just a steady buildup. And I fully expect all-time highs in 2020. And I'd honestly be pretty comfortable saying the 100K is definitely still in play for sure.
Yeah, very interesting. You know, as we know, markets are psychological. Looking at maybe the softer side of narratives or soft narratives instead of maybe metrics and data and fundamentals. It is interesting, though, after sort of the what seemed like coordinated FUD and Elon and just that vicious pullback, or not even that vicious, but, you know, I think for a lot of new money, it was vicious. You know, at the same time, we've had a tremendous amount of good news. And you would think that, and again, I'm not concerned about long term, but over short term, you would think good news would generally push markets up in bull runs. Tremendous good news in El Salvador. It's interesting that the market is still sort of, I think it's actually still churning out the leverage that you're talking about and sort of bouncing back. But it is fascinating that that kind of news is not even stimulating more conversation, I feel like, outside of the Bitcoin community. I'm not sure if it's as price seems to be a bigger signal than even El Salvador, you know, adopting it as legal tender. I'm kind of curious about your thoughts on, you know, because that is maybe one signal of a bear market. Good news, not moving price. So just your thoughts maybe on those narratives and why that kind of news, which you would think nation state adoption would be the next cycle even.
Yeah, I think, I mean, El Salvador was obviously huge news. It's kind of funny, like anecdotally, I've asked a few, you know, friends or people in finance or just in general, you know, what do they think? And they're like, wait, what? El Salvador, what? And so I think maybe it's intentional, maybe it's not. Hasn't gotten much mainstream media coverage. And honestly, like with Bitcoin, it's super interesting. It's just this kind of global market, and really nothing's priced in ever, right? Like I remember MicroStrategy, they announced, I think it was when they announced that they were going to borrow their first big debt offering. They were going to borrow $650 million, and that the funds, they got it. The funds were going to clear and they were going to start buying next week. And an hour after the news came out, so that price is at 11,000, price dumped to like 9,800. And it was like, wait, okay. They just announced that someone was going to market buy like 50,000 Bitcoin or some like ridiculous amount. And like, that obviously has an impact. Like that's going to move the market and the market dumped. And so like, do I believe that markets are efficient? Yeah. But, you know, there is massive information asymmetry, and there is a lot of things that, like, you know, just looking at one data point or one news event, I don't think really matters. I think what moves the price is not El Salvador's announcement. What moves the price is El Salvador and then the 8 developing nations that copycat the strategy, and then the 150 million users that are onboarded to the Bitcoin network over the next 2 years, right? Like, I think that's moving the price. But in terms of what's priced in now, nothing. Like, personally, like I put out, I heard the news a little bit early and I teased on Twitter. I'm like, big announcement's coming. Price is going to get bid really hard. And I was wrong. Like I was totally flat out wrong. People were like, what the hell, man? I'm like, okay, well, yeah, I was wrong. I thought, you know, a nation announcing this was going to be really big. Evidently, like, you know, the market was just like, eh, whatever, didn't budge. But yeah, I mean, El Salvador is freaking massive. And not because, you know, and it's great for the 6-7 million people that live there. It's massive. It's, you know, but $25 billion GDP, like that's nothing, right? Like, and so what's really the big deal is if that $25 billion GDP number turns into 50 in 2 years, and it turns from, you know, so Bitcoin was money for criminals. And then Michael Saylor really, really popularized inflation hedge, digital gold, monetary safe haven. What happens when the narrative shifts to Bitcoin's economic empowerment for developing nations? Like, that's powerful. And like, I think that, you know, El Salvador has a really massive potential to really flip that narrative on its head.
Yeah, I agree. Wild stuff. I'm kind of curious how you frame up Bitcoin as being designed to pump forever.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a couple of ways to approach this, but kind of two in one, where the dollar, the Fed has a stated inflation mandate. And with the credit in the system, there has to be perpetual credit expansion. In other words, monetary debasement for the system to keep going. That is just a mathematical fact. And if they don't, then everything collapses. So in dollar terms, if the system is supposed to stay glued together, over a, you know, longer term time horizon, everything with any sort of economic cost or demand will rise in value, will rise in dollar price in nominal dollar terms. So that's one. And two is the fact that with Bitcoin, with the halving and with the difficulty adjustment and the economic incentive that Bitcoin provides to basically find the lowest cost energy or the most, you know, wasted energy on the planet, Bitcoin and the production cost, like Bitcoin is a commodity, right? So the production cost of Bitcoin, in my opinion, is due to the incentives, is going to rise forever. So with every other commodity in history, you have the price, market price, and you have the production cost. And if price rises above production cost, there's an incentive for everyone on the planet, anybody that is able to produce this commodity, whether it's oil, whether it's gold, whether it's corn, whether it's copper, you have an incentive to go produce that commodity and sell it on the open market and to drive the market value back to the equilibrium production cost. There's a direct incentive, and that's what happens. Whether it's with lumber, what we're seeing, whether it's with oil, whether it's anything, when price spikes with a commodity, there's a huge incentive to go produce a much like vast amount of this commodity, vast quantities of it, and flood the market with supply and drive the price down. Well, with Bitcoin, supply is inelastic. So when the price rises, you have every incentive to go mine more Bitcoin, correct? But there's a difficulty adjustment. So as more and more hash power comes online, because Bitcoin as a monetary commodity rises in price, all it does is, instead of driving up the quantity of Bitcoin hitting the market, it divvies up the Bitcoin into more and more hands. It basically drives up the production cost per marginal unit. So instead of every other commodity where it does the opposite, when the price of Bitcoin pumps, more miners come online, there's a lag, but more miners come online and the production cost rises. And unlike every other commodity, Bitcoin miners, instead of selling as much as they can, they hold as much as they can. And so I believe Bitcoin in real terms, in terms of like, purchasing power or claims on productive goods, is going to rise forever with human productivity. But also in dollar terms, I believe, Bitcoin is going to go up forever.
Yeah. I'm going to read back your words before my final question, then we'll roll out. We are seeing this play out today. The global economic system is so over indebted that there would be a deflationary collapse without ever increasing liquidity injections or stimulus. As a result of rates being stuck at the zero lower bound and exponentially increasing debt monetization, a mass default is occurring, not explicitly, but implicitly. The error term is the value of the currency itself, which in this case is the dollar. A debt jubilee is coming in the form of creditors having their purchasing power wiped out. During a period of debt monetization, the rational economic incentive is to protect one's wealth by seeking out assets that cannot be devalued or printed, like Bitcoin. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. With its perfectly inelastic programmatic supply issuance, it is a logical choice for every rational economic actor to adopt as a primary store of value, medium of exchange, and eventually unit of account for all economic calculations. The incumbent monetary order is irreversibly broken. In a process that has unfolded over nearly a century, the monetary system of the United States and the world has changed, and a small class of people have benefited at everyone else's expense. If you are pro-humanity, then you must agree that a system of rules is superior to a system of rulers. Against the backdrop of technological advancement, a compatible monetary system is needed. Money is the coordination function of every action in the economy, and Bitcoin is the best tool humanity has ever had at its disposal to harness this function. With Bitcoin, money is once again a free market phenomenon, and humanity will flourish as a result. Now, with the incumbent monetary order cannibalizing itself, here stands Bitcoin, a digital monetary network that provides direct incentives for every individual and entity on the planet to adopt it. A great debt jubilee is coming, and it will be later known as hyper-Bitcoinization. Those are Dylan's words, BTization, at BTization on Twitter. I'm kind of curious if you have any parting advice for, maybe even specifically people your age or of any age about what's going on here in this fourth turning and the end of a long debt cycle. I mean, it seems like you've done a lot of research on these issues, and I just don't think a lot of people understand what's coming. Even if you think about it, I think our monkey brain just kind of gets back to what we see on an everyday basis.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely put in a lot of work, and like, you know, to kind of formulate my thesis. And I totally understand that most people, not just won't, but can't, right? Like, I'm blessed and lucky enough to be able to now do this for a living and for a job, and to be able to, you know, share my insights with people and try to help them out. But totally understand that most people don't have time to dig into monetary history and to spend hundreds of hours, you know, reading the white paper and understanding, you know, public key cryptography and, you know, like decentralization of, you know, yada yada, right? Okay. I totally get that. And, you know, so kind of my advice to people, and I really just try to help most people that I care about, really everybody I care about, is, you know, acquire some Bitcoin for yourself, save some value for your future self. Trust me, you know, like, if it goes down next week or month or 3 months from now, that's okay. Put a little bit away for your future self and do it every single day. And whether some people ask me like, "Well, how are you doing? Are you all in?" I said, well, yeah, I've been all in. and so I don't do that tomorrow, you know, understand why, but, the most important thing you can do, for yourself is, you know, here's some resources. If you want to learn, you can, you know, ask me or follow me on Twitter, or here's some great books, but just save a little bit of money. And this is money that it doesn't steal from you. This is money that no one can print or steal from you or take away from you. And that's kind of what I give. That's the advice I give to everybody. And, you know, as you know, I can go far deeper than that, but, I think showing someone, you know, a DCA calculator and saying, "Hey, this is 4 years, put in a dollar a day. That's $1,200. It's now worth 10,000. That's all you got to do." Like, I think that's pretty powerful. So I guess, yeah, my advice or parting words would be, you know, stay humble, stack sats. There's a lot to learn. But the beauty of Bitcoin is that you don't have to be a macroeconomic expert. You don't have to be a finance whiz. All you got to do is save some money. You know, it's that simple.
Yeah. I will agree that you should trust Dylan and stack sats, save for your future self. I will add that do your own research, read Dylan's work, gain your own conviction after you get some skin in the game so that you can get there yourself and understand why you're doing this. But just to round it out, where can people find you? And definitely tell us about what's going on with the deep dive.
Yeah, so I do a deep dive. I do a thing with Bitcoin Magazine. It's a premium product. I publish daily, weekly, and monthly content for Bitcoin Magazine, which is like covers like on-chain analytics, derivative markets, macroeconomic backdrop. It's like, to be honest, I mean, to be perfectly transparent, I wouldn't recommend it to my grandma or someone that's just getting in. But for anybody that kind of, you know, wants a deeper dive on things, you should check it out. Follow me on Twitter at BTCization. My name's Dylan LeClaire. You know, had a great time on here, man. I really appreciate you inviting me, and you know, it means a lot.
Yeah, man, I enjoy this so much. I don't trade Bitcoin or derivatives of Bitcoin, but I really enjoy your work because there's not many voices that I enjoy hearing about market analysis of Bitcoin. And your work just kind of is insightful about, like, it's emotionally insightful in a lot of ways about what's going on in the market. And you're giving like raw data and analytics and analysis that I really appreciate. I'm going to hopefully run it myself one day. It really sounds cool what you're doing with the data. And I just really appreciate your voice and the signal that you're putting out there. So I've enjoyed this conversation immensely. It's been so dope, Dylan. Thank you so much. Dylan LeClaire, dropping macroeconomic market analysis and shedding some much-needed light on the conclusion of the long-term debt cycle and the rise of Bitcoin right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dig the show, make sure to subscribe, share, and learn. Stack those sats, stay humble, and keep in mind that Bitcoin's long-term fundamentals haven't changed one bit. This is Cedric. Peace.